supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, the question of the week is about a dicey problem. What about the potentially contaminated ingredients that go into large-scale commercial compost? It's a complex issue. We'll try to shed some light on it after a massive amount of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Ann, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you today?
I am doing just fine, Ann. How are yourself?
We're doing great here in Naugatuck, Connecticut.
Where is that?
Naugatuck is right near Waterbury. It's along Route 8 and near 84.
I've actually been in Waterbury, and I think I remember the sign for your town. I'm a little dyslexic, and that's the kind of a town name that I could never live in, for instance. I would just wander around the streets aimlessly every time I saw a sign.
We call it Noggy for short.
Yeah, really. Like Naugahyde, right? So it's not even a real town. What can we do for Ann where they make Naugahyde?
My husband and I are hoping that you can help us settle a dispute in our garden.
Okay, now wait a minute. So you and your husband, right?
Correct.
Because I have to say that so far, the odds are probably 95-5 that you are correct.
Okay. If I tell you that he loves squirrels, will that make it an even 100?
Oh, 120. You're correct, and you should change the locks on the house.
My husband is a wonderful, wonderful husband, and he was weeding our gardens, and he made a nice little pile of the weeds, and I added to it with some rose bushes that we're having a problem with that have some disease. And my husband mentioned that he was going to take the pile and move it somewhere else on the property, kind of away from all the gardens. And I said, I don't really think that's a great idea because it may have some diseases in it. But then also, if there are seeds among the weeds, that they may end up spreading back to the garden. So we were hoping that you could lay down the law and let us know who is right and who is wrong.
Well, first of all, there's a little bit of wrong in your thinking. I never would have contaminated a good pile of, quote, green manure like that, especially at this time of year, because, you know, the leaves are going to start falling soon. And when you shred leaves, one of the great natural sources of green to mix in with the shredded leaves is pulled weeds that, you are correct, have not gone to seed. You don't want to put any weeds that have gone to seed. So if there's flowers on them or seed pods especially, you unfortunately have to toss them. But one of the nice things about weeds going into a compost pile otherwise is that you tend to pull them, if you have a good garden with good soil, there's a lot of soil around their roots. So when you throw in, say, a big chunky weed that is not yet flowered and it's got a big chunk of soil around its roots and you mix that up real well with shredded leaves, that soil contains a lot of the soil life that will help activate the composting process. That may be as good a compost activator as anything you can buy. But you are absolutely correct in that diseased plant parts should be put into the trash. And they should be put into their own separate bag, and then that bag should go into a bag with the trash. You really don't want to drag it out in the woods thinking there's like 18 grams of organic matter attached to it that are otherwise going to go to waste, and maybe Al Gore is going to come after you in the afterlife and, you know, demand an explanation. Because some of these spores, things like late blight on tomatoes or black spot on roses, these spores can travel vast distances. The old gardening advice used to be bury it or burn it. I hate burning. We've got too much carbon in the atmosphere already. And burying seems like a lot of work. You are correct. Diseased plant parts should go into the trash. I'll be honest, though, and say early in the season, before there's any seeds, I'm composting all my weeds because they're very nitrogen rich early in the season. But even this time of year, I don't care if my compost sprouts a little bit of disease. I keep my hose really sharp. And when I spread compost, new compost under a plant, I'm ready if a little forest of tomato sprouts comes up or something like that. And I just hoe them down when they're small.
Okay.
So that stuff is good, especially if you collect a lot of leaves, but absolutely diseased plant parts should be wrapped up and trashed.
Great. Thank you very much, Mike. It'll be a nice, calm place in our garden now that we have this dispute settled by you.
No, it won't. No, it won't. Your husband is a squirrel lover. No good no good end can ever come of this. A counseling is the only thing I can suggest. All right. Have a great rest of your summer, Ann.
You too. Thanks so much, Mike.
Bye-bye. 1-888-346-9499. Bob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How you doing?
I am doing well, Bob. How are you, sir?
Fine.
And where is Bob Fine?
I'm fine in South Jersey, Morris River Township.
Morris or Marsh?
Morris.
What can we do for Bob in New Jersey?
Well, I have a problem with squirrels.
Bob, wait a minute. Everybody has a problem with squirrels. Get in line. Take a number.
Yeah, but Mike, they're eating my tomatoes.
Of course.
I never had a squirrel eat my tomatoes before.
Well, they figured out that it would annoy you, so they added it to their repertoire.
Well, they certainly have been annoying me.
Now, are they actually eating your tomatoes, or are they doing the evil squirrel trick of just taking a bite out of each one?
They started out taking a bite out of each one and even rolled them down the blacktop. Roll them down and leave about half of them in the parking area.
So your tomatoes, are they growing inside tomato cages?
No, but they're staked up. I have them staked up, and they're in a bed.
Right.
Raised bed. I have about 30 plants.
Well, you got really one big choice this year, and that's what I use to protect my garden, which is a motion-activated sprinkler.
I got one out there now, and it doesn't affect them.
Are you serious? I mean,
I'm serious. It goes off, you know, when you makes a circle, and it hasn't slowed them down or anything.
Really? Now, that's highly unusual. The only thing then I can advise, and you say you've got 30 plants, so this covers a big area.
Yeah, it's fairly sized. Yeah, very good size.
First of all, this is one reason I really recommend people grow inside of big cages, because when the tomato plant stays inside the welded wire cage.
Yeah, well, I used to do that, but I didn't see any use of it because they can stick their head through that wire, the cages.
Somebody else just told me that, a listener from D.C., and I think I must have either lazy squirrels or my wire's a little tight. They were using concrete reinforcing wire, which is big enough for a squirrel to squeeze through.
That's too big.
Yeah. I use, like, rabbit fencing, which makes it a little more difficult to pick the tomatoes. But if the squirrels get frisky, I can just put some fencing on top of the cages, and everybody gets to go home early. The only thing I can now suggest is that you go out and you get a big roll of chicken wire and you rig up some kind of a cage with a lid on it. I mean, because the things that would work for ornamentals, spraying them heavily with deer repellent or some foul-smelling thing or something like that, that's not going to do anything.
No.
That's not going to keep them away. Squirrels are evil.
Oh, I know, yeah. They're in my bird feeders, too. They can't keep them out of that.
Oh, so you're attracting the squirrels.
Well, yes, but we have a big area here. We have like 6 or 7 acres.
Bob,
plenty of room for you,
there is no reason to feed bird seed in the summertime. They don't need it, and it does make the squirrel problems exponentially worse. The only thing I do for my birds is make sure they have fresh water, and I give them suet in the winter time. The only thing I can suggest is that you go out and buy a hot pepper wax, one of these repellent sprays that's hot pepper in a waxy coating, and then you wash the tomatoes really well, or you peel them before you eat them. But I think next year you got to build yourself some welded wire cages and be ready to cover the tops with more fencing, and you have to stop feeding the seed, at least temporarily. Or instead of bird seed, fill the feeder with hot pepper shake, like they have in Italian restaurants to put on pizza.
Yeah, right.
Because the birds actually like that, and it doesn't bother them. Birds eat hot peppers. But it might make the squirrels think twice about your property. Try redirecting your motion-activated sprinkler. Light a candle to the Blessed Mother. But they are the worst. And once they get into the habit of doing something, it's difficult to break. So certainly don't put any more seed in the bird feeder. And look for hot pepper wax. It may not save you, but at least you'll get even a little bit.
Yeah, right.
All right, Bob. We're sorry, man.
Thanks for the info, Mike. Enjoy your show.
All right. Good luck, sir.
Thank you. Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll be talking about fall planting and gardening second season at 1 o'clock on Sunday, August 25th at Willow Oaks Farm in Bear, Delaware, helping celebrate Benchmark Builders' 25th anniversary. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with lots more of your fabulous phone calls and how to know if your compost is contaminated. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee, a national supplier of seeds, plants, and bulbs, supports You Bet Your Garden and reminds growers that late summer and early fall are the time to plant garlic and spring bulbs and cool weather crops like salad greens and pansies. More information at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, an intriguing question of the week. A listener found out the compost being used in her garden is partially made from food waste. Could it be contaminated with genetically modified organisms? What a great question. We will struggle to answer it later in the show. In the meantime, lots more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Chris, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing good, Chris. How are you, sir?
I'm doing all right.
And where is Chris doing all right?
Greensburg, Pennsylvania. It's about 20 miles east of Pittsburgh.
Oh, okay, 20 miles east of Pittsburgh. That's an interesting area. First of all, I like Pittsburgh a lot. Pittsburgh's a great town. I love that new baseball stadium.
Oh, that's great. It's beautiful there.
And you say east, so how close are you to the Frank Lloyd Wright House? How close are you to Falling Water?
Oh, about 20 minutes. Not too long to get there.
No.
I've never been there, though.
Oh, my goodness. You got to go. It's one of the most stunning places you'll ever see. It's everything it's racked up to be. It might be the best house in the world. You got to go. All right. What can we do for Chris near Falling Water?
All right. Well, I have this eggplant. I grow it in a pot. It's plenty big enough pot. I guess it's probably considered an 18-inch pot.
That's big.
Filled with your mix of soilless potting mix I made with my own compost. And so then I had flea beetles on it and leaf hoppers.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought I got them under control using diatomaceous earth and pyrethrin. Then about a week after I seemed to have gotten them under control, the leaves turned about half of them yellow, greenish color, and they started drooping on me.
Yeah. What kind of eggplant? Are you growing the traditional Italian big black eggplants or the Asian kind of fancy ones?
I believe it's a black beauty.
Okay. And just one plant in this big pot?
Yes, just one.
And it's a plastic pot?
Correct.
And it gets lots of sun?
Yes.
Are you growing other things in other pots?
Yes, I have about 5 different types of peppers all growing right next to them.
And they're doing fine?
Wonderful. Best year I've ever had for peppers.
And you mixed a lot of your compost in. Had you fed them anything?
Yeah, I use fish emulsion.
Okay. That's not just fish emulsion alone.
Well, I also use, it's an Epsoma product. It's a granular. I believe it has a lot of microbacteria in it. I put that in a little bit earlier on in the season, too. But other than that, that's the only thing I've fertilized.
Oh, okay.
With.
But Espoma, a basic vegetable plant food.
Yes.
Be careful with the fish emulsion in seasons to come. That's all nitrogen. So that would be good for a lawn or sweet corn. But it's not the best thing for fruiting crops. For fruiting crops, you want like a balanced organic fertilizer like the one you use. Or a fish and seaweed mix can be really good.
I thought I had ordered the fish and seaweed mix, and I got the regular mix.
Mm-hmm.
But the numbers were still 3-4-1. I've been using that during the fruiting stage, so I thought it would still be all right.
Well, don't overfeed, but that's a good ratio. I don't mind that. And obviously, it's working well with peppers. Well, I find that of all those basic crops, tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, cucumbers, melons, squash, I find eggplant to be the most difficult. Once the flea beetles move in, you're in a world of trouble, as you found out.
Yeah.
They just decimate it. Now, next year, if you want to try growing them again, what I suggest you do is, you know these tomato cages that they sell that are like totally inferior for growing tomatoes inside of?
Yeah.
When you put your eggplant into your pot, I want you to put one of those tomato cages around it. And I want you to buy what's called floating row cover. It's basically spun polyester fabric. You can substitute a very sheer curtain. Hang that over top of the cage, you know, with your eggplant inside. Real spun polyester fabric, real row cover will let all the air and light and rain in, but it'll keep the insects out. And I even want you to tie the bottom of it around the top of the pot to make sure it's a nice tight seal. This will also get your eggplant, which is a real heat-loving crop, off to a better start. In a cool spring, it traps heat inside the row cover, but it never hurts it. And you keep that row cover on until you have multiple flowers open on your eggplant.
Right.
And then you have two choices. You can either take the cover off and hope that all those insects have gone away because they haven't had anything to do in your garden. Or you can just take the cover off on a nice sunny day, take a little paintbrush, move pollen from one flower to the other, and put it back on top. This is what commercial growers have to do. Once flea beetles get established, they're almost impossible to control. Eggplant loves growing under row covers. You'll get the best eggplant ever.
All right. So you think this year, I'm pretty much at a at a loss for my eggplant.
Oh, yeah. Job was a farmer, man. If you've got beautiful peppers, you celebrate that and you don't look at your losses.
Hey, thanks a lot, Mike.
All right, enjoy your peppers, man.
Hey, thanks. Have a good one.
1-888-346-9499. Kristen, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi there.
Hi, Kristen. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I am just fine, thank you. And where is Kristen good?
I'm good in Tri-Cities, Tennessee. Tri-Cities area is Bristol, Kingsport, and Johnson City. And we live out in the county, kind of in between Kingsport and Bristol.
Okay. What can we do for Kristen in the Tri-Cities?
So I have about 8 acres of land, and 4 or so is wooded, and 4 is grassy. When we moved in about a year and a half ago, there was a large patch of kudzu kind of growing over like some low brush and blackberry brambles in one of the grassy areas near the edge of the woods. So we were able to get a lot of the brush cleared and start kind of mowing over the kudzu. We've been able to control it by mowing it down basically to the ground regularly, but the kudzu has kind of moved into the trees.
Uh-huh.
And it's starting to grow up into the canopy, and we're a little panicked because we don't know exactly how to control it at this point now that we can't get to it with the mower, and we really can't even get to it to hand remove it in some areas where there's a lot of brush and there's a lot of blackberry thorns.
Right, right.
So I'm afraid it's going to eat our woods.
Well, it will. Isn't that what they call kudzu? Isn't it the vine that ate the south?
Yeah, exactly.
How long have you been doing your mowing of the kudzu?
Probably about a year.
Okay, because you've been doing the absolute smartest, most intelligent thing you can possibly do. By mowing the kudzu down for a full season, you've depleted the energy reserves in that thing's roots severely. So it's not dead yet, but it is really weak and unhappy. So just keep up the mowing, prevent it from photosynthesizing, and you are following the rope-a-dope method of getting these plants under control. Now, in the woods, there are devices you can buy. I realize you can't get a tractor back there, but there are high-powered weed whackers. Now, you need to be wearing protective equipment when you're using these, but instead of a string trimmer, they kind of have a metal chain on them. These are brush whackers. So what you got to do, if you want to save these woods, you got to wade into it, and then when you get to where the kudzu is coming out of the ground, all you got to do is cut it off at the ground level. You're probably going to want to be cutting trails into your woods anyway, right?
Sure.
So you fight your way back, and you work in quadrants. And that's really all you need to do. Keep these trails open. Once you fight your way through like the pioneers, every time will get easier. Once the area is relatively cleared, could you get back into your wooded area with a machine that looks like a push lawnmower, a walk-behind lawnmower?
It is a pretty steep slope, so I don't know how difficult that would be.
I was going to say there are lawnmower-like devices called brush hogs that, again, have like super powerful things under their decks that are meant to go into the woods and take out brambles and blackberries and small vines and stuff like that.
Okay.
You figured it out in the meadow. Constant cutting is the smart way to deal with these plants. And then in the woods, you definitely want to try to keep the kudzu under control. Now, the nice thing is once you fight your way back to where the vine is coming out of the ground, you don't need to take it out of the tree. You know, it's not parasitic. It's not even epiphytic. It's just trying to climb anything it can. You see, it's not even a good climber. It's not really good at it. It just finds a lot of different handholds. Once you cut it off at the base or close to where it comes out of the ground, that whole top of the vine will die and brown off. your job is to just do the best you can, try to limit its effects on the woods, and gradually make these trails and clear the areas. Don't try to do it all even in one season, but you can really, only one person can take care of 1 acre a year in this kind of a situation. But maybe even next year you want to hire some help and really go in, really mechanically remove a lot of this stuff, make good trails, and then it should be a piece of cake for you to go in with different tools and just keep cutting it off at ground level. You could also hire goats. Goats would eat the kudzu and all these other plants.
Oh, that'd be fun.
Yeah, no, you can hire a herd of goats. See if there's an eco goat herd in your area. You only hire them for like a short period of time, and they come out with goat herders and portable electric fences. These goats take care of everything, man.
Great. That sounds like a plan.
All right. Well, you got a bunch of plans in there, but it sounds like you have the energy and you have the will. I think you're going to do it. Just make sure you don't stress yourself out in any one season. It's slow and steady wins this race.
Okay.
All right. Good luck, Chris.
Thank you so much.
Take care. 1-888-346-9499. Mike, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, I got a question for you about tomato plants.
Mike, I have a question for you.
Okay.
Where are you?
I'm in New Jersey, at the shore.
Okay.
And I have a tomato patch. And I was just wondering how to increase the amount of tomatoes per tomato plant.
Okay. Have you grown tomatoes before?
Yes, I have. I usually give it Miracle-Gro or something similar, 15, 30, 15.
Yikes! That's like a high explosive, man.
I do that every 2 weeks.
Oh, no. I mean, you'll destroy your soil over time.
Okay.
That's massive amounts of extremely harsh chemical salts.
Oh, okay.
And you say you're down the shore, right?
I'm in Long Branch, New Jersey.
Okay.
Central Jersey.
Okay.
North Jersey Shore.
And you say you're a block from the beach.
Right.
Okay. So that's a difficult growing condition to begin with.
Right.
Do you grow in raised beds or flat ground?
Flat ground.
Have you ever done anything to improve the soil?
I used peat moss and cow manure.
Who told you to do that?
I've read about it.
No, nobody ever told you to use peat moss to grow tomatoes.
I just added it to my soil. I just added it to make the soil lighter or whatever.
What people don't understand about peat moss very often is it's highly acidic. So it's added to soils in which we're going to grow acid-loving plants. Things like azaleas, rhododendrons, blueberries. On the East Coast, our soils already tend to be a little acidic, sometimes too acidic. So you have definitely lowered the pH well.
No, I also added 20-pound bags of lime to raise the alkalinity. Mix that in. I mix that in, rototill that in.
Okay.
So I use peat moss, lime, and with the soil.
Okay. And do you rototill every year?
Every year before, usually in May or April.
And don't you notice that your weed problems are massive?
I don't really have too bad of weeds. I really don't have too bad. I have one or two weeds, but I pull them out.
Well, rototilling, first of all, releases all the nutrients that are in the soil. It depletes them. And it exposes weed seeds. Perhaps you don't have as many weeds because you're down in a strange environment near the Jersey Shore. Now, what kind of tomatoes do you have growing? How many plants? And
I have 10 or 12 plants. They are beefsteak, some heirloom tomatoes.
Right. And do you have a lot of big green tomatoes?
I have a lot of green tomatoes.
Okay. If you've done this before, you know that the beefsteaks and the heirlooms, they take 90 days to mature from the time you put the plants in the ground.
That's what it is.
So that is perfectly normal. But you are almost being an environmental criminal by adding those chemical salts so close to the ocean. You really don't want to be using... You know, no one should be using anything that's 15, 30, 15. That's a high explosive. But especially when you're in an ecologically tender environment. So
I didn't know that.
Next year, what I suggest is you kind of rope off areas that are 4 feet wide,
right,
and have walking lanes that are 2 feet wide, and get a big load of compost delivered. Do some research, find a place where you can get some compost, and build some nice raised beds with the compost. And don't step into the area where you're growing your plants. Don't walk around the roots of your plants. That's bad for them. Just stay in the walking lanes. Grow your plants in the compost-enriched beds. The compost will provide all the nutrients they need without any kind of danger to the environment. No more peat moss, no more lime. You're like the mad scientist of tomato growing there. And then about halfway through the season, get yourself a nice fish and seaweed fertilizer and mix that with some water and use that to feed your plants once or twice. And the plants don't need that much food, especially when they have a rich soil to grow in.
Oh, okay.
All right, man?
All right. Thanks a lot.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I'll be the guest speaker at the second annual Frenchtown Green Fair, 1 o'clock on Saturday, September 28th in Frenchtown, New Jersey. And I'll give a free talk explaining how to turn your fall leaves into garden gold at an event sponsored by the Lower Merion Conservancy at St. Joseph's University on Wednesday, October 23rd at 6:30. But don't go looking for all the compost-rich details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and whether GMOs are in your compost. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden and reminds growers that summer is the time to obtain garlic and spring bulbs for planting in the fall, as well as seeds for fall crops of pansies, salad green seeds, and other cool weather lovers. Learn more at burpee.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to an intriguing question of the week. Should you be worried about genetically modified organisms in certain kinds of compost? What a question. I wonder how I'm going to answer it after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Sharon, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Sharon. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you.
And where is Sharon doing well?
In Bellefonte, Pennsylvania, the center part of the state.
What can we do for Sharon in Bellefonte, PA?
Well, my two kids, who are 19 and 21, the three of us have built a sunflower garden for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
We have a patch of lawn that's about 12 by 12 feet. And rather than having to mow the grass, I thought, let's have a garden there. And never had sunflowers. So in the spring, I was in the grocery store, and I saw these burpee sunflower seeds. So I picked up three different little packets of three different sizes of sunflowers. And so we planted them later than most people. It was late June, so I was going around town and I saw other people's sunflowers are already blooming and ours are just very close to blooming.
That's fun.
Yeah, so one of my neighbors is really into gardening and she told me that I'll never have to buy seeds again because if I dry these, then I can take the seeds out and plant them next year.
Well, that
so
depends.
I'm calling, when do I cut the heads of the flowers off, how best to dry them, when to pull the seeds out, and how to store them.
Okay. So first we got to back up. There are essentially two different types of sunflowers.
Okay.
There are ornamental sunflowers that grow from like 6 inches tall to 3.5 feet or 4 feet, and they come in every color of the rainbow, a huge variety. And then
okay, those are the short ones we have.
Okay, so you did not grow any of the mammoth Russian oil sunflowers.
Yes, you did. Those are the tall ones.
With any seed saving, it's very important that you allow the seeds to dry on the plant. So you can't cut the flowers at their peak because the seeds follow the flowers. So you're going to be harvesting at the very end of the season, especially with your late start. Now you're also going to have an interesting situation in that birds are going to try to eat these seeds once they're ripe.
Okay.
And you're probably going to notice the birds going into the sunflowers, and that's going to be one of the signs that the sunflowers are ripe. Now, have you seen bees going back and forth and everything like that?
Just starting to, yeah.
Okay. So you're just at the beginning of stages here. Now the pollinated flowers have to, like, produce their seed. That'll probably take another month. How many mammoth sunflowers do you have, the giant oil heads?
A dozen.
Okay. Once the bees stop visiting them, what you want to do is you want to go out and you want to buy a row cover, a roll of spun polyester fabric that's called row cover, or you want to get some sheer curtains. And once you're sure that all of the seeds have been pollinated, you know, no more bees are going in, but now the seeds are developing, you actually want to wrap the heads of the sunflowers. Because otherwise, birds and squirrels are going to eat every seed.
Okay.
So, and then you're just going to wait until frost is predicted. When frost is predicted, you're going to go cut the heads off. You're going to bring them inside, and you're going to cure them. You're going to put them in a cool, dry spot, like ideally under a ceiling fan or something. Try to harvest them when they're dry. Don't harvest them during a rain or right after a rain. Make sure they're nice and dry, and then spread out newspaper, and you just shake the heads, and the seeds will come out. And you want to keep the seeds cool and dry till next season. You can actually eat some of the sunflower seeds. You know, you can roast and toast them and salt them and everything. But you want to keep them cool and dry in, like, sealed glass jars where the combination of the temperature and humidity in the room is less than 100.
Okay.
They shouldn't freeze, and it shouldn't be damp. Now, the tiny ones, the ornamental ones, did you save the seed packets?
Yes.
Okay. Don't save any that say they're hybrids or F1s, because those won't come true. You need open pollinated seeds to save seeds. And the seeds of the smaller sunflowers are going to look radically different. Some of them won't even look like seeds. But you would follow the same procedure. You may see little birds going for the sunflowers, and that's the time to harvest them because that means the heads are ripe, and the smaller ones are more difficult to protect.
Well, great. Thank you very much.
All right. Good luck with your sunflower adventure. And remember, keep an eye out for those birds because they can clean you out in one day.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Good luck, Shar.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Jack, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you, Mike. It's good to talk to you.
It's good to talk to you, sir. Where are you?
I'm in sunny East Tennessee, but we're getting a little rain today.
Well, rain is sometimes good. We've had a very wet summer, but it's been very productive for me. And, you know, biggest problem has been the weeds. What can we do for Jack in Tennessee?
I had heard your comments in talking with somebody last week about the poison ivy. And I had a section of my lawn that's been where I've had pine trees planted for the last 30 years. We finally decided to take them down. Of course, during that time, as you mentioned, the birds light and they shed their poison ivy seeds and many other types of vines. So I've got a lot of poison ivy and ivy that my wife planted. So I'm going to get rid of all that, and may sound awful to you. I'm going to spray it with gasoline because I know
that's... Oh, God, no, Jack, you can't. You can't. That's a federal crime.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
Okay.
No. Don't introduce gasoline into the environment. I mean, oh, my God, you could poison people's wells. Somehow you managed to find the only thing worse than chemical herbicides. No, you would never.
Well, listen, I am really glad I called. This is the first time I ever called. The question I had the other day was, I said, you know, you talked about using garden gloves and then pitching them when you got through. I've always used rubber gloves because I'm an orthopedic surgeon. And I have all the discards, so I just use a put on a couple pair of rubber gloves, and when I get through, throw them away.
Okay,
and
so
that's always worked well for me. I've never had it seep through the rubber gloves.
You're talking about poison ivy.
Yeah, poison. I just pulling it up and trying to work it out, get it
right.
Pulled up.
And I don't actually advise using garden gloves for poison ivy. I warn people not to because the allergenic oil gets on the gloves. And then every time you touch something with those gloves or every time you use them again, you risk getting the oil on your skin. The answer to any of these vining weeds is to really soak the soil when you're using poison ivy. I like using the plastic bag trick and using fresh bags with every pull. But with ivy, the ivy that your wife foolishly planted, you see, that has a waxy coating. That is going to shed any kind of herbicide. So that really has to be pulled. There's nothing that's going to adhere to the ivy long enough. But you also say that this is a lawn, right?
Yeah, it was before we planted the white pine trees years ago, and the trees have been cut down now, and I've got a guy that's going to come in and plow.
You're going to plant a new lawn this fall?
Right. I'm going to plant this fall if I can get all the roots and the tree stumps up.
Well, you got to get the tree stumps up. That's the most expensive part of the job. It's easy to cut down trees.
Well, that's right, and they look ugly, and the people that grind them up, it just leaves a big pile of sawdust and ruins. I'm going to get the guy he has a pretty good-sized tractor, and he's going to plow all around through there and get the big roots up, and he says he thinks he can just jerk the stumps up once he gets all the roots.
So when he's doing that, just have him put a rake on the back. He can rake away all of the vining weeds. And then what you want to do, because you're going to plant a cool season grass, you're going to plant fescue or bluegrass?
Yeah, I've done pretty well with zoysia up here and there. Yeah.
Then you would do this work slowly over the winter because you want to do the plugging in the spring when it greens up again.
Yeah, I'll probably go ahead and sow, though, Mike, some grass seeds so that they'll get green early, and I'll just put some zoysia plugs in, let them creep over the next 5 years.
Okay, that's fine. So what you want to do is you want to make sure you get everything plowed up, level the soil really well. That's the secret to a good-looking lawn. Have a big load of compost or rich black topsoil delivered. Spread that an inch thick on top. Level it again. Sow your seed in that, and then just keep the seed moist for like 5-7 days, and you will have a great-looking lawn. Even if there's some remnants of these vines left in the soil, if you do that, if you get this thing established by the end of September, and you have a nice, rich seed bed, and it's nice and level, the lawn will outcompete the weeds.
Well, that's good to know. I wasn't sure how that would work out.
Okay, Jack.
Okay. Yes, sir. It's mighty good talk to you. Thank you a lot.
All right. Good luck, sir.
Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. Do genetically engineered foods make unsafe compost? Alexis Landis, please read us this week's very intriguing question.
Sure, Mike. We heard from Margaret in State College, Pennsylvania, who writes, "My community organic garden receives compost that has always seemed really excellent. But I made the mistake of asking what went into it and learned that some of the raw ingredients were leftovers from a university food service. I know they are not serving organic food, so I have to assume that some of the ingredients include GMOs, genetically modified organisms. It's my understanding that at least some herbicides and chemical pesticides can break down into harmless substances during the composting process. Is the same true for GMOs? Are they rendered inert? One reason I've become so suspicious was a supposedly organic fertilizer I found in the garden center of a big box store, whose list of ingredients included chicken litter. I knew that the chickens probably weren't raised organically, and that their feed would likely contain GMO corn, so I decided to err on the side of caution and not purchase the fertilizer. Then I learned about the problems with arsenic in chicken litter and was really glad I passed. Any insight you could shed on the risks of using compost that might contain GMOs would be appreciated."
Issues surrounding the raw materials that go into compost have been around for decades. Cow manure sourced from factory farms, for instance, would be expected to contain residues of antibiotics and growth hormones. And as our listener wisely notes, you can add arsenic to the list when chickens are involved. Tests conducted by the FDA and Consumer Reports last year found such high levels of arsenic in some American rice that had been fertilized with chicken litter that a group of prominent pediatricians warned parents to limit their children's consumption of rice that had been grown in certain states, or to just avoid the grain altogether.
Mike, why would there be arsenic in chicken feed?
Because in our brave new world of so-called conventional farming, arsenic is added to chicken feed as a growth promoter and eggshell strengthener. And there's a different concern with horse manures. Horses aren't over-medicated like animals raised for consumption. But as we have been warning recently, if horses graze on fields where the weeds were wiped out with a persistent herbicide, they'll ingest some of it. And some of these herbicides are so persistent that the composted manure of affected horses has killed plants. So here's a case where we know that the composting process didn't make an herbicide inert.
But what about her question? What about GMO foods?
Almost all of the non-organic corn and soybeans grown in the United States have been genetically modified to tolerate applications of the herbicide known as Roundup, so massive it would kill normal crops. Roundup is a systemic herbicide, meaning it's taken up through the root systems of these plants and into the actual corn and soybeans. So I would personally worry more about eating something like, quote, conventional corn chips or tofu, as some of the corn and soybeans used to make these products have been found to contain as much as 13 parts per million of the herbicide, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it actually is. Now, food waste is notoriously difficult to compost, especially, quote, leftovers, which are often fried, salted, ketchup, you name it. So I wouldn't be surprised if much of the food involved in this compost making was actually raw. You know, wilted lettuce, apple cores, broccoli stalks, and other stuff that gets trashed as you're preparing food. Since she's already been snooping around, I would suggest she continue and ask, A, what percentage of the raw ingredients was food? B, how much was kitchen waste as opposed to things like tray scrapings? And C, exactly how was it composted? Was it done with worms or some sort of advanced fermentation process? You can't pile up lots of food waste outside. The vermin issues would be fast and furious.
And commercially produced compost is supposed to be tested, right? So she should be able to get paperwork that shows the pH, nutrient content, and contaminants in the finished product.
That's absolutely right. But no matter what, her material is likely to be safer than compost made using contaminated manures or clippings from a chemically treated lawn, as some herbicides used professionally on lawns have also been shown to produce, quote, killer compost. You know, this is a dicey issue in a dicey world. And unfortunately, there is some weed killer in virtually every bite of conventionally grown corn and soy. That unfortunate reality made me give up one of my favorite snack foods, which was otherwise great. It was high in fiber, low in salt, low in fat. But Mrs. McGrath's little baby boy ain't be eating no Roundup. I suspect that her compost is safe. Perhaps wonderful, but you should always ask to see the paperwork with bulk compost, and you should give every new batch the duck test. If it looks like good compost, smells like good compost, and feels like good compost, and the paperwork is good, it should be good compost. Well, that sure was an interesting and somewhat disturbing look at the wide world of possible compost contaminants, now wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to feed me Frankenfoods if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live. Please, please, please. Please put the actual subject in the subject line and check first to see if the information you seek is waiting for you at the Garden Answers A to Z section of our website, youbetyourgarden.org. You can also listen to the show, listen to this week's podcast, and follow us on Facebook. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Charlie Kyer, rhymes with hire. Rich Banowitz and Sarah Kazar, You Bet Your Garden's Internet Illuminati. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at our Facebook page. Our unaltered enablers include editor Al Banks, production assistants Jolie Higazi and Cecily Garber, and Alexis Landis, who produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. My wife keeps talking about having me altered, but I think she means something else. And I'll see you, hopefully, next week. Homegrown sweet corn is one of the true delights of summer. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal the safe natural sources of nitrogen you can use to correctly cultivate this hungry, hungry crop. Plus your fabulous phone calls.